Day. The size of the agenda today seems to be in just directly inverse proportion to the size of our audience, so we'll see what happens here. Is everyone planning on talking a long time on whatever bill they're here on today? No kidding. Okay, let's begin, I guess, right at the top of the agenda. With House Bill 226. And on that, we have just John Phillips, who is here with Senate. Thank you, Kathy. Senate Bill 226, who's here. John Phillips, who is here with his godson, Nelson, I understand today, who attends Candelaria School. So, Nelson, we welcome you. John, are you going to bring him up to the witness table? Come on up. Madison, would you please tell us about Senate Bill 226?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 226. Of course, as it seems, it came to us from the Senate Revenue Committee and also passed the floor. And Senate Bill 226, when it started, it was a Department of Revenue bill. It attempted to fix some timing issues with the county assessment funding. This is the fund that is also known to be the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance Account. The fund used to get the payments in on the 15th, and this bill attempted to make a difference in days between money coming in and then the money going out on the 21st. However, after that, it was passed, it came to the attention of the different parties involved, State Treasurer, the Department of Revenue, and assessors, that the process as crafted in Senate Bill 226 might face some timing difficulties yet. So introduced the Dash 1 Amendment, and the Dash 1 Amendment takes into account the also the coming in of the funds, changes not only the coming in of the fund on the 21st, but it changes the payments back to the counties on the 24th or 25th day of the last the month following the last month of the fiscal quarter. As it stands in theory, this timing change and the changes in the account with interest and the differences between time, it might, for the first time this action to be taken, will constitute a small revenue impact because of the timing difference that might impact, but it's nothing to will sustain, and it will smooth itself out after a couple times. No fiscal impact.
And revenue impact, you're talking about indeterminate, you're talking about nominal?
Minuscule.
Minuscule. Okay, we can accommodate that. Okay. Nelson, would you like to tell us what the bill does? I'm sorry, John.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips, Department of Revenue. I think Mazin's covered it all. We had a very simple, it would be the simplest bill you have all session probably. We have a time frame where deposits are made from the county and we distribute the money subsequently. And the time frame in the statute has us doing those two things on the same day, and it's really not possible. So we, by rule, have been doing it with a little bit of staggering. We thought we just should bring it in and have a law change. And when we brought it in, we found out some counties weren't interpreting our rule the same way we thought they were operating, and so there was some non-uniformity. So this will work this out with the treasurers. They've met in their annual conference just a couple of weeks ago, and they've agreed that this is what they can do with the Dash 1 amendments. And so it's just a matter of getting money and getting it back out.
Okay.
Be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Are there Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an example, isn't it, where everyone looks and says, well, the legislature really is an idiot. And don't answer that.
Thank you.
I'm wondering why it is that we can't just do this by rule rather than having it in the statute at all. I'm not going to interfere with this bill, but this is the sort of detail that seems to me would be a perfect thing to put in a rule rather than in a statute.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that it could very well be in a bill. It's been there for quite a while, I think since 89, and so we've just been working with it. Trying to accommodate that.
It is a fair comment. Sometimes the more specific you get in statute, then the harder it is to change it. And obviously, you can only do it once every 2 years if you discover a problem in the interim. I think they'll agree with you rather than get in the way of this as long as everyone's signed up. John, this is something that the department may want to look at. You come back even in the next time and ask for some broader rulemaking authority on this and other kinds of things that don't necessarily need legislative oversight. Okay. Any other discussion on House Bill, Senate Bill 226? Got to shift gears here as we move into this segment of the session. Senate Bill 226. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 226? If not, I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 226.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hess.
Chair, I would move Senate Bill 226 to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation. And additionally, I would nominate it for a consent.
I was just going to, as the calendar gets longer and longer, my principal.
We need
the dash ones. Representative Fast, do you want to amend your motion?
I would amend my motion to amend Senate Bill 226 with the dash one amendments.
Okay. Representative Fast moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 226. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Any objection? Hearing none. Now, Representative Hess.
I would move Senate Bill 226 to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation on the consent calendar.
I was just going to say, as the calendar gets longer and longer, my principle gets shorter and shorter on consent calendar issues, and I think this is one that we could probably save everybody 3 minutes on, perhaps. So I would be happy... Thank you. Happy to accept that motion and the recommendation for consent calendar. Any discussion? You're hoping to carry us. Please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Barr.
Aye.
Taft.
Aye.
Hopkins.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
No, motion fails. Aye. Senate Bill 226 goes to the floor on the consent calendar with a do-pass recommendation.
I knew that if Representative Verger was there, I was safe.
That is at least good for Coos Bay. Okay, let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 221. Who's that, Dick? Oh, yeah, it is. Sure, it is. Income tax. And Deborah Buchanan, why don't you come on forward while we're getting this one up? Elizabeth.
Chairman Shetterly and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. Now, with Senate Bill 221, this is a Department of Revenue bill that is quite simple. This issue was actually even brought forward when we had the CPA's summary of tax law changes and things. So this has already been addressed somewhat in previous discussions. But what this is doing is allowing the Department of Revenue the discretion to extend the time period in which taxpayers must make tax payments to the state if there is an action by the Internal Revenue Service or a state-declared emergency that impairs Oregon taxpayers' ability to pay their taxes or the government's ability to perform certain duties within the certain law time limitation. So basically, it's trying to address the issue of when there may be a state-declared emergency or other actions in which states have recognized that there could be a need then to allow taxpayers additional time to address tax issues, as well as additional time that the state government may need in order to perform certain duties. So this act is consistent with the provisions in the Federal Victims of Terrorism Tax Relief Act of 2001. Which allowed the IRS the authority to postpone certain deadlines and required actions for victims of the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks, as well as other disasters occurring after September 11th of 2001. So there's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on this bill.
So thank you very much, Representative Barnhart. This is one where we're not, by statute, extending a deadline to the 15th day of the third month next following the due date of the tax. This is giving the director rulemaking authority. Yeah, Deborah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I think Liz Betts has said it all. I'm happy to answer any questions. It's simply a matter of trying to be preemptive, recognizing that something may happen, and this would give us some flexibility to provide taxpayers some time to comply with statutory requirements.
Okay. Questions? So we have two events that would on which this authority is predicated. One is an IRS action or a state-declared emergency.
Correct, Mr. Chair. The IRS, following the terrorist attacks, extended the time for making estimated tax payments. At that time, we realized we probably did not have authority to delay the date of making a payment of estimated tax or other tax payments. And then so we had some group discussion and talked about other situations that could arise, a deadline for complying with reinvesting in property, for example. There are certain time periods for doing that. If you fail to do that, then you can't defer gain. If an earthquake or a tsunami hits and you can't do that, then we would be able to say that deadline could be extended because of a state declared emergency.
Okay. Question? I guess my only question, and the process for declaring a state emergency obviously exists outside this bill. Did we talk about that? Is there some other process for declaring a state emergency? Is that a governor's proclamation?
I believe it is by the governor.
Okay. Any other questions for Deborah? Does anybody else want to testify on Senate Bill 221? All right, I'll close the public hearing.
Thank you.
And open a work session on Senate Bill 221.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
I move Senate Bill 221 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Scott moves Senate Bill 221 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Is this another one for the consent calendar?
I don't know. What do you think? This one's it's pretty taxpayer friendly. It's worth just mentioning what this is, right? That's it, isn't it?
I suppose when we're being friendly to the taxpayers, we ought to say so.
That's the new standard.
That's it. My new principle. Okay, Representative Barnhart moves House Senate Bill. I'm sorry, Representative Scott moves Senate Bill 221 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion on that? Please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Barr?
Aye.
Pass?
Aye.
Austin?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 225 goes to the floor of the due pass. Who wants to crow about this bill? 221. Thank you. I'm going down my agenda. Representative Barnhart.
Tax family.
All right. Senate Bill 221. Close the public the work session on Senate Bill 221. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 225. Oh, I'm sorry. That's Mazin and John Phillips again. And Nelson. Mazin.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mathematic Legislative Revenue Office, Senate Bill 225 is also a Department of Revenue bill, and in its purest form, this Senate bill started as a form of a cleanup, Measure 50 type of cleanup. It deals, first of all, with the payments that the port properties make to schools in lieu of property tax. As you know, these properties pay a quarter of a percentage to schools in lieu of property taxes. This to be determined at this time by this Senate bill on real market value rather than assessed value. As I spoke to different counties when we had this on the Senate side, most of them indicated that that's the way they do it anyhow, on real market value, but it seems like there possibly be some that don't. So in that sense, this might leave a little bit of revenue amounts coming to the schools accordingly. The other sections of the bill deal with the partial assessment and special assessments. It puts into the language, the Measure 50 language of the maximum assessed value, the frozen growth type of concept. And that's the way it came from the Senate and passed from the Senate Revenue Committee through the Senate floor. As it is in the House, we had a dash one amendment, and the dash one amendment came as also a cleanup on an issue of the surviving spouse of a veteran. There was last session the law to allow the surviving spouse to petition for exemption. There was some mix-up in the language that it wasn't clear which of the years, whether the current year or the past year, would qualify for this. The amendment clarifies this point and allows that exemption to be for a longer, or the window to apply for the exemption in a longer time. And with that, we have, as I mentioned, a small revenue impact for the whole bill for the schools out of the going to the new market value, and possibly small also reductions in the counties and other districts because of the Measure 5 capping to to the maximum assessed value concept on the special assessments and the partial assessment.
Okay. Small. Is that like minuscule again? Or?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. John Phillips.
Good morning.
Walk us through. You've got, it looks like, one of your good handouts here, including the one on the amendments. So why don't you just walk us through those quickly? Okay.
I'll go through this quickly. Mm-hmm. John Phillips, the Department of Revenue again. Senate Bill 225 is sort of a reconciliation and catch-up on issues from even the implementation of Measure 50. And briefly, in Section 1, what we did in Measure 50, a lot of times we just sort of a global search and replace for real market value, we put in assessed value. And this is one of those instances that it doesn't really apply. In lieu of taxes are paid on, they're paid on assessed value, which is the lesser of real market or maximum assessed. Since port properties are exempt from taxation, they don't really carry a maximum assessed value, so there's no lesser of test. So we were just suggesting discussion with the assessors, and I've talked to the ports, the folks that represent the ports, and this seems to be one that will work, and it's what they're doing anyway, for the most part. Doesn't really have much of an impact, since for that type of property, most of the time you're going to be taxed on the real market value anyway because of the nature of the property. Sections 2 and 3 deal with the freezing of maximum assessed value. There was a decision made during the implementation of Measure 50, creation of that bill, to say that at such a time as what you have is real market value was skyrocketing at the time. It was going up really, really fast, and people's property taxes were following that. And so maximum assessed value was limited to grow at only 3%. Well, at such a time when the market, it takes a downturn and drops below what the maximum assessed value would be, and then it bounces back up, you could get, over a period of time, you could get a much steeper increase than the 3%. So what the law said for most properties was is that if at such a time as real market dips below the maximum assessed then freezes until such time as the real market catches up again. That was done for most properties, but it wasn't in the law for forest properties, for farm properties, and for other types of property, some specially assessed property. In 99, there was language for the forest land values. There was a bill on that, and that was addressed at the time, and the freeze was given to those types of properties. Last session, we had a farm bill, and the farm, in that language, it was brought up. And these are just the last two programs that we can identify that don't, that were not given that freeze benefit. So it's just two sort of small, otherwise innocuous programs, but it brings them consistency. Section 4 deals with the applicability, and 5, codifying. Section 6
is again back to specially assessed properties. There's a way to determine the taxable assessed value, the assessed value, maximum assessed value for these properties. And it says in the Constitution that for these types of properties, they'll be calculated as provided other provisions of law. And there isn't really a general overriding statute in Chapter 307 that deals with special assessment that says what that calculation is. There's a lot of selected sections that say for historic property, for example, this is how you do it, or for low-income housing property, this is how you do it, but this would give us sort of an overriding general rule that's consistent with the Constitution. Section 7 is just a simple changing the word granting to governing, just to change the character of that. Sections 9, 10, and 11 really deal with one issue from dealing with how counties appraise property. Counties appraise property based on a mass appraisal basis, and when computers were first introduced into that process, there was a statement in law that said the department shall guide and shall write rules on how to do this, and that's really changed now a lot because of different appraisal principles and the way we appraise property under Measure 50. And so a new statute was created back in 97, and now we have statutes that guide that kind of give direction along those lines, and so we're just repealing the one, retaining the most recent. That's all, so they're not in conflict. And the
amendment
was an issue that came up after our legislative concept development process was finished, and we spoke with, there was two interpretations. The counties had various interpretations between themselves, and we had an interpretation. We were in the process of writing a rule, and we thought it best to talk with Senator Dukes, who had sponsored the bill, and say, here's some different ways to look at it. What was your intention, and how did we get there? And we spoke with Dexter, and we've had this amendment drafted to address that issue. It extends the time. The point of the bill last session was to extend the timeline for surviving spouses where the veteran dies just before the tax year begins. And so this will, I think it was a unique circumstance where the veteran, they'd acquired the property just before the beginning of the tax year, within 30 days, and then the veteran died within 30 days of the purchase. So it was the surviving spouse saying, here, I just got this home, and I'm just traumatized by the death of the veteran, and I didn't really have the wherewithal to make an application. This gives them a little extended time frame.
Okay, so you've worked this out with Senator Dukes?
Yes.
Okay.
She's happy with these amendments.
All right. Are there questions for John Phillips on Senate Bill 225? Or for Nelson. Nelson, what grade are you in?
Third.
Any other questions for Nelson? Pretty bright. All right.
Just to make sure that he's okay with the dashboard.
Yeah. That's a good support. Okay. If nobody else wants to testify on Senate Bill 225, I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 225.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Berger, we have dash ones.
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 225.
And Representative Berger moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 225. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Bill 225 with the amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. What's the committee's preference? Do they want to talk about this or speed things along on this bill? Technical enough for everybody to do a consent calendar? Mm-hmm. Be satisfied with that? Okay.
On this consent calendar?
If you want to amend your motion.
Okay, I'll amend my motion to move Senate Bill 225 to the floor as amended on the consent calendar.
Okay. Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 225 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be placed on the consent calendar for consideration. Is there any, discussion on that? If none, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Barr?
Aye.
Pass?
Aye.
Austin?
Aye.
Pat?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
All right. And the Bill 225 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Let's do 2166 next. We have some amendments on that. Open a work session on House Bill 2166. Elizabeth.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2166, you have a big amendment here, and it's really not so bad, but it is to dash A4. And we heard last time this bill with the dash A3 amendment, the issue was there was a revenue impact in the 03-05 biennium. So what the reason why we have the dash A4s is really to just extend the revenue impact to the 2005-07 biennium. So in order to do that, we have to get some various changes in the statutes because we're going to make two different applicability years for the different portions of the bill. So what this amendment does is it deletes your existing A and gross bill. That's what the fourth line does there, deleting pages 2 through 6. And it then is going to be incorporating in the dash A3 amendments as well in this A4. So basically with the bill, I'll just briefly go through the different sections. But the first section there is just the definitions for you, and it does include the A3 definitions and things. And then in the Section 2, we are saying that these definitions apply to tax years beginning 2004. And then in Section 3, then we have the remainder part of ORS 315.164. It's deleting the definitions because we already put those in Section 1. But then it's bringing in the remainder part of 315.164 with the changes in the dash A3. Now, basically what this is doing is in this section here, Section 3, it is applying to tax years beginning on or after 2004. That's what Section 4 does. But in Section 3, this language specifies then on page 4, line 11 and 12, it specifies that no more than 80% of the credit may be transferred. Well, that is the part that was causing the revenue impact. So in 2004, we still have this language that no more than 80% of the credit can be transferred. You don't have that 100%. So then, again, you move on after Section 4 to Section 5, which is, again, the same language, ORS 315.164. But what it's doing then on page 8, you can see that it is amending this portion dealing with adding all or a portion of the credit can be transferred. So then that's where you're getting your revenue impact. And then in Section 6, you can see that Section 5 applies to tax years beginning 2005. So that's just the way that council has to write this, and it looks, you know, really confusing, but it really is doing what, you know, we had hoped it to do with allowing the other portions of 315.164 to apply to tax years beginning on or after 2004, but not that portion that has a revenue impact, which is the allowing 100% of the credit to be transferred. That is going to apply to tax years beginning 2005. Okay. And then, yeah, then just the rest of the bill is just a couple other statutes, 315.164 and 315.169, again, all applying to tax year 2004.
Okay, thank you. So this, if you recall, committee, this bill, Lynn Parton, why don't you come on up? We did mostly two things, I think, two big things. One was the adding the acquisition cost to the credit, mm-hmm. and the other was increasing the amount that could be assigned from 80 to 100%, and it was the increase from 80 to 100 that had the revenue impact, and I think I was the one who asked for the A4s. We've done this on a couple of other bills. My purpose on this is to, rather than wait for all of the rest of the pieces to come together in the next few weeks, my intent was to keep this bill alive moving forward, get it down to the Senate, and then to the extent that we are able to accommodate the revenue impact in the current biennium, have it available for the Senate to make those amendments. And in the worst case scenario, we just delay the revenue impact or the increase from the 80 to 100% until the next biennium. But that was my strategy in doing this, to keep this bill moving forward so that it doesn't just get caught up in a backlog of House bills over here, which we're going to have anyway. But I thought if we could keep some of these moving forward, we'd just facilitate the speed of the at which we can deal with these as we move on. Representative Verger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to be sure I understand. Is there any impact in the 0305?
No. For the record, my name is Lynn Parton. I'm in Housing and Community Services Department. Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, no. That's the purpose of the amendment.
Okay. We
all of the other, I may just specify, all of the other changes that we were hoping for are still taking place in 2004. The only thing that's moving out is the one with the revenue impact, the 80% to 100% transferability.
Okay.
So. Again, we may be able to accommodate an amendment in the Senate to put that back in, depending on how the rest of things can be together.
We're actually very happy with this.
Are you really? Okay.
Yeah.
You're happy with it, even if this is all you get?
Well, this gives us everything that we want. It just gives us one piece of it a little further out, but we're patient.
Okay. That's good. Any questions for Ms. Parton?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Just a quick refresher on the an example of selling or transferring the credit to a taxpayer that is subject to taxation, how that works in the real world and how often.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, how that works in the real world is in the vast bulk of the financial value of the tax credits. Actually, the big community-based projects are generally built by nonprofits, and they can't take the credits. So in order to get any equity into the projects, they have to sell the credits to banks. They can sell them to individuals, to corporations, whoever is a tax-paying entity and is interested in, especially banks, can get Community Reinvestment Act credit in addition to the actual value of the difference between what they pay for the credits versus what they actually get from the credits. So that's usually how it happens. There are for-profit people who also transfer, but that's much more rare.
Satisfied?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate your cooperation on this, too. Does anybody else, I know we're in work session, anybody else want to weigh in on the Dash A1 amendments? A4 amendments, sorry. I put my file away. All right, then we are in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Farr.
I move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2166.
Okay, Representative Farr moves the Dash A4 amendments to House Bill 2166. Is there discussion on those amendments? Any objection? Hearing none. They are in. Representative Farr.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2166 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Farr moves House Bill 2166 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? All right, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Farr.
Aye.
Hess.
Aye.
Hobson.
Aye.
Hess.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2166 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier.
I would be honored.
Okay. Representative Farr.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2166. Let's see. Who's in the room? Steve, you're here. Dick's not. Oh, Dick, you're here. Okay, let's do the tobacco. We got a bunch of folks lined up to talk about that. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill
2368.
It comes to us from Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs, but this is the first time we've seen it.
Yes.
Okay? So tell us about it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Richard Yates with Legislative Revenue. Briefly, because you have people here who are sponsoring the bill to go through it, it revises the cigarette and other tobacco products tax laws to facilitate enforcement and compliance. It grants the department powers over distributors' licenses, additional powers to cancel and revoke those licenses. It builds a better paper trail, essentially, through records and record retention, allowing them to investigate better where cigarettes are moving and whether tax has been paid or not. It increases and actually provides for graduated penalties relative to the existing law. It also addresses internet and mail order sales, both with respect to sales to minors and with tax, with respect to tax compliance. It also allows the Attorney General to investigate these cases whenever the fraud is involved, which currently they have to be requested by the department to essentially investigate. It takes effect January 1st, 2004.
All right. Thank you very much. We have on the sign-up sheet Matt McCauley and Don O'Meara. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt McCauley. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Oregon Department of Justice. I am assigned to the Tobacco Compliance Task Force. I think many of you already know Don O'Meara, Section Manager with the Department of Revenue. As you're aware, the legislature created the Tobacco Compliance Task Force in the last biennium for the purpose of increasing compliance with Oregon's tobacco tax laws and to effectively deal with the associated crime that surrounds noncompliance. During the last year, the task force has been able to conduct a number of investigations, both criminal and administrative, that have aided us in determining the effectiveness of the current statutory scheme for both enforcement and compliance. If you'd refer to, I think Mr. O'Meara just were passing out a handout, page 2 and 3 have a schematic that we've designed to illustrate the difference between the statutory scheme as it was originally conceived and as it currently stands would be on page 2. The way the world of tobacco is right now is illustrated in page 3. Tobacco distribution and consumption is vastly different, as you can tell. What we have today that did not exist back in the 60s and the 70s is internet and nationwide Indian country tobacco sales, significantly increased tobacco taxes across the country, not just in Oregon, the master tobacco settlement, and international smaller tobacco companies vying for market share with large tobacco companies and all the things that are attributed to those.
It just looks to me like the guy who did the HIPAA flow chart must have got his hands on the tobacco distribution system.
Well, it's intentionally complex so that we can illustrate the landscape. Based on our experience that we've had over the past year with both in criminal and administrative enforcement of ORS 323, which is the state's tobacco law, we have had the opportunity to consider a number of additions and amendments to the statute that we think will give it the best enforcement structure possible. We first looked at this bill, or we first looked at the option of changing the current law because of the problem with other tobacco products. These, as you may recall, are the world of tobacco is divided into two substantive categories. One are cigarettes, which are defined by law. The other is everything else that contains tobacco. Primarily, that's chewing tobacco, snuff, cigars, pipe tobacco, and roll your own. The problem with the current law was very plain to us, that there was a requirement that if you were distributing other tobacco products that you'd be licensed, and then there was no mechanism to enforce the licensing requirement, which meant almost nobody got licensed. And if you were not licensed, there was pretty much nothing else that the state could do to enforce compliance with that law. That has the result of that has led to extremely widespread non-compliance with the tax and a real significant problem with tax evasion or avoidance when it comes to other tobacco products. That being the case, we took a look at the law and were invited to make some changes and some amendments to make it more consistent internally and externally, more enforceable, easier to administer. One of the things that we really were aiming at was also to help level the playing field. We knew that there was enough noncompliance out there, that it was substantial enough of a problem that it was heavily impacting local brick-and-mortar legitimate distributors and retailers negatively. And so we wanted to give those folks a hand in leveling that playing field. And we also wanted to make the law clearer for the businesses who are affected by the tobacco law. The bill before you was drafted in a joint effort by the Department of Justice, the Department of Revenue, Oregon State Police. We had input from most of the large tobacco manufacturers, from Philip Morris and RJR. We think that the only additional burden on business that we're looking at through this bill is, are there two, and they are have to do with requirements that we want to put into the other tobacco product sales invoice. One would be a distributor's license number and then a certification that the tax has been paid or will be paid by the distributor. The problem with OTP really is that there's no tax stamp that goes on other tobacco products. And the tax is paid quarterly after distribution or sale of the product has already occurred. And so you can imagine that it's very difficult to track down who's paying that tax and who's not paying that tax. Overall, then, the first page of the handout lists the compliance problems for both cigarette and other tobacco products and the solutions that we think that the House Bill 2368 addresses. You can read those for yourselves. We're seeing a lot of untaxed cigarettes going directly to consumers, mainly through the Internet. There's currently insufficient deterrent in the criminal sections, the criminal penalties that are in the Act. The tax increase has also made that extremely lucrative for smugglers and others willing to avoid that tax. Compliance problems with other tobacco products we've already outlined, and we're looking basically at strengthening licensing requirements, tracking the paper trail, and increasing the penalty for avoidance. I think Mr. O'Meara also has some comments.
Okay, very good. Mr. O'Meara. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Don O'Meara. I'm with the Department of Revenue, committee members. Maybe to illustrate a little bit the impact that we have had, or what we have been surprised by, is the level of noncompliance with the other tobacco products when we began from what we thought when we started the task force. We have one auditor from the Department of Revenue who spent probably 80% of his time doing audits on the tobacco products, and in 15 months he's discovered somewhere over $2 million in unpaid other tobacco products. There's one situation where the task force has issued search warrants.
Executed
search warrants. Yes. On an individual related to distribution of untaxed other tobacco products. And we had feedback the following week from other legitimate distributors that their business had increased 30% in that first week following the action. So I think you can see that there is a lot of unfair competition for legitimate distributors, and our goal here is to try to close that gap. Just one other bit of information. When the task force was created, there were revenue goals set for the programs, and to date, with just a couple of months left in the biennium, we are exceeding those goals by a little over $6 million. So
great.
I think we're having some success.
Good to know something's coming in above projections. Good, thank you. Questions for these gentlemen? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several, if I may. I'm concerned about the interstate issues. Can we get extraterritorial jurisdiction in some way? Is that what these amendments are about? I'm reading 676A, for example.
These are the delivery sales
right.
amendments?
Yes. I mean, how does that work?
Well, there are two ways in which we, as a task force, approach the interstate issues. The first way in which we do that is our task force has, there are federal agencies that cooperate with us on the task force, U.S. Customs, ATF, U.S. Attorney's Office, FBI, IRS, and they do have that interstate jurisdiction, and they assist us in those interstate investigations. The amendments particularly will become part of state law, and I think that there is a legal threshold that a out-of-state company or business can do enough business with the state of Oregon that they establish a nexus with us that allows us to do criminal and or civil enforcement on it.
Okay. And a follow-up then, what is the criminal penalty for violating these permitting, the permit requirements and the other requirements in those lake sections?
Okay. So, Representative Barnhart, you're also referring to the delivery sales section?
Correct.
Okay. My understanding, and you have to understand that before I get to that answering that, is that though our task force drafted most of the changes to this bill, the delivery sales portion of that was drafted by Philip Morris and was added in at the last hearing. The Attorney General's office supports the general concept of the delivery sales provisions, but we understand, too, that we have some things that we need to tweak to make that flow right. And the first part of your question was, and I have now forgotten what it was.
Having to do with penalties.
Okay. I believe that the penalty is an A misdemeanor for violation. The criminal penalty is, and there's also a civil penalty, which would include a fine.
Okay. This is a different topic.
Oh, that's fine.
If I may.
You got the floor.
Are there restrictions in this bill against giving away cigarettes, or alternately, are the people who give away cigarettes required to pay the state taxes on them anyway?
I believe that Representative Barnhart, Mr. Chair, I believe that the current law deals. We're not changing anything dealing with that, but the current law already effectively deals with that. And there are some exceptions for, you know, based on the quantity. If it was a large enough quantity, I believe the tax would be owed, and that the tax would be owed under those circumstances.
I mean, part of my interest is giving away cigarettes to college students in order to get people to start smoking, and I prefer that didn't happen, of course.
Of course.
Would like to see if we can do something about that, but that's not in this bill.
We have not specifically addressed that problem.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a Russian company, and I'm going to send cigarettes into this country. Do I have to have a permit to have a delivery sale in Oregon?
Representative Berger, Mr. Chair, it's a loaded question. It depends on how you bring your cigarettes into the country. If you're going to bring them in to the country to have mass distribution from a distributor located within the United States, your company and the U.S. distributor would have to receive customs licensing and ATF licensing for distribution of your product within the United States. There would be tax and duty paid on the import. However, what you may be alluding to are, for example, Russian-made cigarettes that are sent via mail or UPS directly from Russia to the consumer in the United States.
Right.
And under those circumstances, you would not, the state of Oregon would probably not know that sale occurred under the current law, and two, the manufacturer would not have to be licensed in order to do that. This is really, you're illustrating the big problem. It's not a state problem. It's not just an interstate problem. It is a global and transnational tax avoidance problem.
Sure.
Because many of these companies, at least 300 of the 600 internet sites that are currently up, are located outside the United States. And that's why we work with U.S. Customs and ATF and the FBI. They have to meet federal law as it pertains to cigarette distribution. And part of federal law with cigarette distribution is that if they transport cigarettes into the U.S., they're supposed to notify the Department of Revenue of who they're mailing it to and what the quantity is. We've sent letters to all 600 internet distributors. Not one in the world has notified us pursuant to federal law of who they're mailing their cigarettes to. Right. Hmm.
Oh. That does not surprise me. Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. The other thing is you have here Oregon law prohibits shipping to individuals under 18, requires the payment of all applicable taxes. Do you think of these global businesses that they are going to add a tax, and where is the liability? Is it on the person that ordered them from over the internet?
Representative Berger, Mr. Chair, the answer to that is actually pretty plain. The current law, and we've actually clarified it in the new bill, says that on cigarettes, the ultimate tax liability is always with the consumer. And in fact, the federal act, which is called the Jenkins Act, is aimed at getting that consumer information on otherwise untaxed sales to the Department of Revenue, so the Department of Revenue can send a tax bill to the consumer. And so that's with the tax liability is ultimately on the consumer. What we're really looking for, we don't have a way to reach out to Russia or reach out to Venezuela and have the manufacturer or the distributor overseas prepay that tax. We just don't have a way to do it. And so that's why we rely on federal law. Unfortunately, it has not been a big priority for the federal government to enforce that act until recently. I think the nationwide revenue crunch that's affecting many, many states has got the states working closer with the federal government and enforcing the Jenkins Act. And in fact, our task force is heavily involved in doing that.
One last question, Chairman. I noticed that a part of this bill is certainly aimed at underage smoking and people who are doing that. And, over the last few years, Oregon has really done a very good job in prohibiting advertising on billboards that are aimed specifically at underage. And what I have observed is that while they can't advertise in 17 magazine and they can't advertise on the billboard, now they are enticing movie stars to smoke in film, which was very popular during the 40s. Mm-hmm. And so here again, people always find that little pocket that they can slip out of to take care of it. And I just thought I would mention that observation to you, because I believe that particularly very popular movie stars who have been enticed to smoke in the movies will have a greater effect than the billboard advertising. So I don't know how you plug up that, but I think that it's something that bears watching.
And Representative Verger, Mr. Chair, you've highlighted again a really important aspect of the tobacco industry. It sells a highly addictive substance. We've noticed that every time the state has moved to plug specific holes, there are ingenious people somewhere who come up with ways to market and to sell and to move and distribute and avoid taxes very often around those holes. What our bill is really aimed at is creating a legal structure that allows us the flexibility to change with the moving tobacco environment and to make the penalties for noncompliance really enough to start to deter bad conduct. Currently, if you're a tobacco distributor and you're looking at a $1,000 fine, that's really nothing if your annual revenues are $13 to $20 million. So,
if you would indulge
me, I would indulge you.
One other thing on your tax revenue source, where the lawsuit against Philip Morris has been successful, and certainly will maybe be aimed at other tobacco companies. Are you worried that the money that we are looking for in our tax settlement could be dwindling if these companies were to go out of business? Philip Morris, of course, is the biggest one, so they went after the big cheese. But I think that the pattern could follow, and I'd really appreciate it if you'd comment on that.
Representative Verger, Mr. Chair, I think anybody in state government considering the overall situation with our master settlement agreement payments that come to the state would be concerned if the companies that make those payments can no longer do so. And certainly we are. It's not technically revenue in the sense of taxes, but it is revenue in the sense of money paid to the state. One of the big issues, and it's being dealt with in a separate bill, House Bill 2094, deals with the state's ability to more effectively administer and enforce what's called the non-participating manufacturers aspect of the Master Settlement Agreement. And in that, our task force will play a fairly active role in enforcing the provisions of that law. That also has criminal penalties attached to it. And it's a very, you know, you mentioned earlier the Russian manufacturer, the hypothetical Russian manufacturer. The truth of the matter is that we have about five to seven large global tobacco companies. There are several hundred smaller tobacco companies, and almost all of them are located offshore. And so dealing with those effectively in the landscape of distribution and retail and the landscape of the Master Settlement Agreement is extremely complex. And there are a myriad of ways of avoiding tax and putting at risk the Master Settlement amounts.
I would agree.
Thank you. You're welcome. Further questions? Comments? Tell me about the tweaks. Does that mean we need? I know we'll have some other testimony on this, but do you need some time on amendments as well?
I was not, Mr. Chair. I was not. Pete Shepard, our Deputy Attorney General, had been having conversations with Jim Gardner from Philip Morris and some others, Bob Russell for one from Transportation Association, the Truckers Association, and there are some difficulties with just, I think, the delivery sales aspect of the amendment, and I believe that we have already scheduled a work group for ourselves to get together, and we're committed to work out any difficulties that have arisen with that. And I think Mr. Gardner is aware of the Deputy Attorney General's plans and will communicate that to the committee.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I may, Donald Mayer, Department of Revenue. There is another issue we'll need a little more time on. Coming out of Ways and Means, there's a funding issue for the task force.
Oh.
And we expect an amendment to House Bill 2368 dealing with that, but it wasn't ready today.
Okay. So. Very good. That's fine. This is complicated enough that I'm happy to hear it today. We've got some testimony from Mr. Gardner, Mr. Russell, Mr. Cross coming up next, and then probably set this off maybe the next week sometime to give you some time to get your amendments out and maybe meet with them and see if we can work out all the wrinkles together.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's bring up Mr. Gardner, Bob Russell, and Bill Cross.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm a partner with the law firm of Gardner & Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Philip Morris. Just very briefly, the delivery sales amendments that are currently in the bill were our amendments. We would commend to your attention the A6s, which is essentially a modernized, updated, and somewhat shortened version of the delivery sales amendment, but accomplish the same objective, which is aimed at getting some additional tools in the hands of the state to police enforcement of the tax laws and distribution laws for these particular category of internet sales. And to answer Representative Barnhart's question, there is a recent Second Circuit decision which upholds the constitutionality of actually more draconian steps than this with regard to internet sales of cigarettes, and I'll be delighted to furnish that to Representative Barnhart and counsel for the committee.
I would enjoy seeing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Another issue that has come up is the enforceability of these provisions, and on the A6s, you will notice that it is that standing is conferred upon manufacturers to actually enforce, in addition to the Attorney General, so that this company has, Philip Morris has brought dozens of lawsuits already under laws of various states aimed at enforcing provisions against contraband sales, illicit sales, and it would be certainly contemplated that that likewise under the Oregon provisions we would be a vigorous ally of the Department of Revenue and the Department of Justice in enforcing these provisions. Just to give you a sense of the magnitude of the problem, there are credible estimates by third parties that the problem of contraband, untaxed, gray market, black market sales within the state of Oregon may now be north of 30%. That has a direct impact on the state in two ways. First, in excise tax collection, but second, in MSA collection. We really have a kind of a trio of bills aimed at dealing with this, as was mentioned before, 2368, 2094, which is just cleared Representative Williams' committee, and then a bill in the Senate side we're still trying to move, which is aimed at the situation of a judgment that's unbondable and thus unappealable, which is similar to the Illinois situation. We have agreed to conduct a work group that will be convened by Pete Shepard Monday. The things that we want to look at are effort to accommodate the UPS FedEx concerns about shipping documents, essentially. I believe Mr. Cross is going to raise some additional issues regarding NPMs.
Okay. All right. Bill Cross. NPM.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here today on behalf of the Council of Independent Tobacco Manufacturers. This organization recently retained the services of Mr. Marshall Cope and myself to represent them in some of the bills that Mr. Gardner has referred to, particularly House Bill 2094, where the state is looking at additional regulations on non-participating manufacturers. And these independent manufacturers are non-participating manufacturers. They are compliant manufacturers, but they weren't involved in the initial legal suit and are concerned about some of the provisions in here, the additional enforcement provisions and licensing requirements within the Department of Revenue. Similar legislation was recently defeated in Virginia, and this proposal here would impose some requirements that no other state has for non-participating manufacturers. We have sent the information back to the coalition and are eager to participate in the work group. By then, we hope to have a better understanding of what the impact is on the non-participating manufacturers.
So your testimony today is you're not concerned, you're not exactly what sure what those concerns are or how they work out?
Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, that is correct. We were recently retained. We're trying to be brought up to speed, and these amendments were amended into the bill in the House Business, Labor, and Committee, Consumer Affairs Committee, right before it came out of committee, and that's the first time we kind of were contacted by the coalition about becoming involved.
Okay. Representative Bird?
Yes, thank you. This might be an unfair question, Bill, then. Do you have reasons at this point about why you would oppose the licensing requirements that are in the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I know that is one of the issues they've flagged, but okay. I'm not comfortable as to, other than the fact that no other states evidently have that requirement, what the extent is of their concern.
Okay. That's fine.
I invite Mr. Cross to come up and just put that on the record. I was aware of it, and I know that we've got this work group continuing, so that will give them a chance to at least address that and come to consensus if we can, and if not, then it'll be up to us to make the policy choices. So, but it'll give you a shot at it anyway in the work group first. Okay?
Thanks. Sure, we appreciate that. Thank you.
Russell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. And we have some concerns about the Angross version of the bill and at least one set of the amendments. from the standpoint of people transporting these things. And in a sense, I sort of feel like we've got a hold of a balloon and we've been trying to squeeze it together on one end and it shoots out on the other. And so let me explain to you what's been going on. We met in March with the Department of Revenue, and then we met again with them in early April to sort of work through the concerns in the original draft of the bill. And at that time, the Department of Revenue was asking that transporters that transported these cigarettes from various locations in the United States and outside of the United States provide notification to the Department of Revenue whenever they transported any cigarettes that were destined for Oregon. Unfortunately, that doesn't comport with current practices in our industry. We don't know necessarily what's in a package. We go pick up a package, and there's no indication of what it contains. So it was difficult for us to provide that information. You have Dash 5 amendments in front of you today, and these were drafted at the request of the Department of Revenue, and they fixed that problem. So I think we're happy as far as that's concerned. Then Mr. Gardner did the delivery service amendments, and in the current version of the bill, one of the requirements is that the delivery service verify that the cigarettes have stamps. And I'm sure you've seen a pack of cigarettes, and on the bottom of the pack there's this little stamp that indicates the tax has been paid. Well, if you go pick up a package or a box and you don't even know what's in it, it's difficult to verify that the stamps are on the cigarettes that are inside the box. That has been partially addressed in the Dash 6 amendments. That part is no longer, or would be removed in the Dash 6. However, the Dash 6 says that we have to comply with a notice that the seller is required to put on the shipping documents. Well, in today's transportation world, there aren't shipping documents. It's all done electronically, and there is not a bill of lading, freight bill, those kinds of things that used to exist in the transportation marketplace. So, sort of briefly summarize our concerns. The current practices in the industry make it difficult for us to comply with some of the things that are being requested of us. So that's one portion of it. It would be difficult for companies as large as the ones that we're talking about that have worldwide operations to customize their services solely for the purpose of dealing with cigarettes destined for Oregon. Now, when we talk about delivery services, we're really talking about two types. We're talking about the private companies, but we're also talking about the Postal Service. And the Postal Service, generally speaking, is not subject to state law. So one of the concerns that we discussed with the Department of Revenue and our desire is to help with this problem, is that if you put onerous burdens on the private sector transporters, then what's going to happen is the shippers are simply going to move to the Postal Service that you can't control or you can't get information from, and it will be even more difficult to police this problem. So there is a competitive issue, and your inability to control a federal agency that creates part of the problem. If you put too large of a burden on the private sector transporters, you're going to lose the ability to get the information that you need to, in fact, enforce the law. So we are also part of the work group. I have been assured that our concerns will be addressed, and we'll see you next week.
Okay. Any questions for these three gentlemen?
I'm just wanting to make sure that I understand. I thought you said that a trucking company may haul packages and they have with no idea what's actually inside the box.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, of the package delivery services?
Yes.
That is a true statement.
Okay.
Now, there's different kinds of trucking companies, but this delivery sales defines basically what the transporter is, and it's USPS and parcel or package services. A large trucking company like Yellow Freight or someone like that, they have bills of lading. They're covered under another section of the law. That portion of it with the Dash 5 amendments is fine. We've been working together actually for a number of years in trying to address this problem.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. What we will do then is put this off either a week from today or perhaps Friday, give the work group a chance to work this thing through. What I'm hoping for, of course, then will be a set of consensus amendments, and maybe just to signal and not to suggest that we want anything less than consensus amendments, I guess to the extent if the work group comes to a point where you're not able to agree, my request would be that we have some alternative amendments to move on, because I do want to get this thing moving next week in one form or another so we don't have to go back to the work group. So if you're just not able to agree on some points, bring us some alternative amendments, and we can make those choices then when we hear the testimony. But clearly the preference would be for you guys to work this out so we don't have to. Okay? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2368 then, and we'll conclude today with I think it'll be a brief work session on 3449, not to move the bill, but to, Pat, if you want to come on up, look at what we've got on amendments on this, just to be prepared. So I've opened that work session. And Steve, if you want to bring us to date, and we've got Patty up to speak to us and see where we are.
Mr. Chair, members, you have before you House Bill 3449, a -4 version of the amendments. There's two or three differences from the -3 that you saw at the last hearing on this bill. The first change is that language was added to clarify that this only applies to Portland School District. The language in the -3 was a little bit broader in that it could be interpreted to apply to a couple other school districts that have gap bonds. So that's the first change, and that was done by putting language in there that it applies to a school district that has a statutory rate limit greater than $4.50 for $1,000 of assessed value, along with the gap bond. So that,
by definition, that applies only to Portland.
Correct.
Do we know that the other districts that this might apply to did not want the same? I'm just curious.
Let
me say this. I guess we've heard from Ozzy, who certainly is in contact statewide with his districts, and he's happy with these amendments. Ozzy,
Chair Shanley, correct. Yes. And the other two districts were very, very small, and we think one of their gap bonds was up anyway, and we weren't sure, so we just didn't want to inadvertently affect something that affected the state school fund.
The second change is on page 5, where you have the new language that if the Portland changes or pays off their gap bond and goes to a higher tax rate, that the increase in the taxes would be also exempt from the local revenue used in the school equalization formula. The change here is that it's either A or B. It cannot be both at the same time, as the prior language would potentially have allowed. Okay. And then you still have the same changes in terms of the local option, 15% and 750. That has not changed. The rest of the language, and there's more language here than in the -3, is to deal with the problem of amending both the temporary statute changes and the permanent statute changes, and making it so that in 05, when the two have to come together and be identical, that everything works in that process. So you'll see some of the additional language dealing with that problem.
Patty, do you want, I guess I forgot to ask you to identify yourself and then give us your pitch on these.
For the record, I'm Patty O'Sullivan, Portland Public School District. Chair Shetterly, these amendments, this is a really convoluted sort of thing that one thing can affect another. I probably had more green visor time with with Steve and Jim Scherzinger that I ever wanted to have, and I don't feel any smarter afterwards. We concur with these changes. They were technical, although not minor technical, but fairly major technical in essence. It still does the same thing that I've come around and talked with all of you about. It just makes sure that it doesn't inadvertently do some other things at the same time. And we do agree with, I've had a conversation with Senator Decker, conversation with yourself about adding this to some of the bill that you're going to get when they come over from the Senate. So there are ones, I think, here and ones on its way.
Okay, so that's why we're not going to be moving these. We'll be amending these.
Right,
Senate
so
bills.
That you'll be looking at an entire school funding package
okay. I think
or
that was
formula
one
package.
By some of the members about this being a piece, but only a piece, and so we've got a bigger school funding bill coming over from the Senate, and this will allow us to move that into that bill so we can see the whole thing all together. And
correct.
I asked Patty to come in today, since these amendments were ready to talk about, just to kind of keep this on the medium burner anyway, not the front or the back, but since this will be something we'll look at one more time when it comes in.
Correct.
But bottom line, this is done in such a way we're not disadvantaging any other school districts.
That's correct, and that's why it was done separately because it was brought by my school district. But it was also done separately to keep the committee members knowledgeable that it is not a formula bill because it doesn't affect the formula. So when we go ahead and put it in the package, it's not like it has a winners and losers list like some of the other pieces of the package will.
But we did talk last time about the out years. Mm-hmm. Next biennium, there actually will be an increase.
It'll actually be an increase of about eight and a half million dollars to the formula when the desegregation dollars fold back in, which we're agreeing not to to extend the sunset
right.
on, so or try.
Mr. Chairman, is the intent to fold this into the other bigger bill?
Yeah. So we have the school funding piece all together.
In two bills. Everything will be two bills, Senate Bill 550 right. and Senate Bill 819, which are coming to you from the Senate Revenue Committee.
But we can hear those together then and deal with all that in one piece so everyone can look at it all together.
I guess that one of the reasons that I've been very supportive of this bill is that I figured that it was Portland's decision made about Portland schools. And whether I agreed with what Portland did, I like to give them the privilege of doing that. Is that going to complicate a position if you fold it into another bill?
Okay.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Verger, I don't believe so, but the bill has had a hearing. I mean, if something goes awry later and there's not support out of this committee for 819, then it can still go on its own. But I feel pretty secure that Senate Bill 550 and Senate Bill 819 are coming to you after the numerous hearings and negotiations and talk on the other side. And I'm hoping that that the committee will be happy with the outcome of those two bills. I think there's something for everybody in there, or for most.
And by ultimately moving these amendments into one of those bills, these amendments will still be discrete in their impact.
Correct. And so you are judging these on their own validity, and then you'll look at that bill. If you want to put them together and send it, great. If not, we can send this one alone.
All right. Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. O'Sullivan? Okay. Brian, you're here. Do you want to?
I'm Patty Scales. I think I have a question for her.
Okay, come on up. Stay.
Brian Reeder, Department of Education. I don't know how much detail you know about certain provisions of this bill that deal with the gap bond rate and what happens to that rate when the gap bonds are paid off. Under current law, that rate becomes subject to the Measure 50 reductions, which it wasn't subject to back when Measure 50 passed, and then that rate would be rolled into the permanent rate and would become part of the local revenue for the formula. This bill says that when the gap bonds are paid off, that rate is not rolled in. Whether or not it's rolled into the permanent rate, I don't know, but that portion of it is not considered local revenue, so it is not subject to an offset, state revenue offset. It applies only to Portland. I guess my question for Patty is, why does that make sense, other than Portland needs more money, but then so does every other school district in this state? So why does this make sense?
Do you want to have this discussion in front of the committee, or do you want
Representative Satterley, I believe that Brian and I and my boss can have this discussion outside the committee. I've explained to the committee why this makes sense in our view, and I'm really sorry he's kind of come in late on this, but we'll have a conversation.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think I'd be happy with that. With that, then, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3449 and committee, unless there's anything else. We're adjourned.